Good morning, everybody. I'm going to call the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee to order for on Thursday, February 26, 2026. There is a quorum present. First agenda item is approval of the minutes. Representative Smith, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
Yes, Chair Cagle. I have one small correction. It says on here that it's Jeff Dotseff. My understanding is that that's now Seth Dotseff.
That needs to be corrected.
No, I move approval of the minutes without correction.
Thank you so much. Representative Smith. Representative Smith moves adoption of the minutes for February 2026. Do I hear any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And Representative Elkins, you are going to be taking the gavel. First bill on the calendar today.
Oh, I got here just in time, didn't
I? Yeah, there you go.
Are we ready to go? Chair Cagle, would you like to move your bill? We're hearing House File 3642, Virtual Currency Kiosk Prohibited.
And the motion is delayed over? Or what was the motion?
The motion is delayed over.
Oh, the motion is to lay this bill over?
Thank you.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
And there is a...
Yes, I understand you have a DE author's amendment.
Would
you like to move the author's amendments before describing the bill?
I move the DE1 to House File 3642.
Okay, so members, the DE1 author's amendment is before us to get the bill into the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, say aye.
Aye.
My coffee hasn't kicked in yet, sorry. All opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Chair Cagle, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 3642, as amended, is a bill to prohibit crypto kiosks in Minnesota. Because these kiosks are relatively novel and minimally regulated, we have heard from our law enforcement that they are a prime target for scammers who are looking to take advantage of our loved ones. Because of the nature of cryptocurrency, these fraudulent transactions are often irreversible and incredibly hard to track. In an instant, an entire life savings can disappear without any recourse or restitution. The service kiosks are redundant at best, as most people who wish to purchase or sell cryptocurrency do so by using apps like Coinbase and Robinhood. In 2024, we became the first state to attempt to regulate these kiosks. While I appreciate the efforts of my colleagues in 24, the problem still persists. Fraudsters are still taking advantage of some of Minnesotans' most vulnerable for thousands of dollars at a time. This bill gives us an opportunity to work across party lines to protect the people of Minnesota from irreversible financial crimes. Please join me in addressing this issue. Again, this bill is being laid over, and I'll continue to work on it with the Department of Commerce, Representative Perryman, and then Representative Allen, who I know is carrying a crypto kiosk bill as well, and anybody else who'd like to have a good faith discussion on how we address this issue. So I thank you so much, and I'm going to turn it over to Representative Perryman to say a few words on this bill as well.
The key there is few words. I'm Representative Bernie Perryman, and I'm honored to sit with Representative Cagle. You know how there's a perfect storm a lot of times? Well, this happened in St. Cloud. I have a testifier from St. Cloud who brought me into this conversation about a week ago, and they told me about Representative Cagle's bill, which was awesome, and that I saw real-life instances that my local police showed me, and the fraud. And the thing that really hit home was the people being frauded is aging individuals. They're going with the belief that they're putting $1,000 in these machines and going to where it should. And then they're scammed and fraud, but they're worried to admit to it, right? We all have pride, and as you get older, That's me. You get more pride. And they're afraid to tell their family I was, you know, frauded at these machines. So that is what brought me into this, and being laid over makes me even more inspired, because we can still work on all this together and make it right, and help all our Minnesotans to understand that we're watching their backs, and that our law enforcement are endorsed as well as they want to stop it too. So again, I'm very honored and humbled to be on this bill, and look forward to the journey with all of us together. Thank you.
And that we can call up our testifiers.
Okay, yeah, so welcome to the committee. So our first testifier is Jake Lanz, sergeant with the St. Cloud Police Department. Okay. And on deck is Lynn Lawrence from Woodbury. And Sergeant Lanz, would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Jake Lanz. I'm a sergeant with the St. Cloud Police Department, and I oversee our criminal investigations unit. I just want to say good morning, thank the committee for their time, thank the chair and Representative Perryman for having me here. So this isn't unique or a unique problem to St. Cloud. This is something we're experiencing statewide. Our investigators regularly have to conduct financial crimes investigations, and within the past couple of years, we've definitely identified an issue with these Bitcoin ATMs, specifically in our jurisdiction. Just to kind of mirror what Representative Perryman said, it also is notable for us that it is definitely a target of our aging population. In particular, we had a case within the past 2 years of a 78-year-old woman that it all started out as a notification on her tablet at home that she had some explicit images, and she was directed to one of these ATMs. And by the end of the whole scenario, she had lost $80,000. These cases for us to investigate are incredibly difficult based off of how the money moves through from the ATM and then transactions that typically lead overseas outside of our jurisdiction to recover the funds anyhow. I have looked over some of the language that the legislature was able to pass in 24, and I agree with the purpose of it, but thanks to our analyst in St. Cloud that helped me with some of these figures and compiling data, of the few dozen cases that we've had, which resulted in several hundred thousand dollars lost, over half of those would have fallen outside of some of the windows for protections and things like that that we tried to, or that you all tried to put into place to protect these folks. So I just wanted to be here today to voice my support for prohibiting these ATMs. It's going to protect our citizens in St. Cloud, which is my primary concern. But statewide as well from these frauds and scams. So thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. We next have Lynn Lawrence, Detective Woodbury Public Safety Department, followed by Larry Lipka, General Counsel of the Cornflake. Hey, Ms. Lawrence, will you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, I am Detective Lynn Lawrence, and I'm with the Woodbury Police Department. And I am one of our financial fraud investigators, and we are keeping very busy with that. So despite the statewide laws that were passed recently, these machines still remain one of the most effective tools that scammers are continuing to use to steal money. Once the victim deposits the cash, as we all know, it's very difficult to get back and to stop. Couple of recent examples I'd like to share with you. 2 weeks ago, Woodbury Patrol officers received a call from a witness inside of a gas station of a female who was at the Bitcoin ATM and appeared confused. Officers and detectives learned that the female had been part of an ongoing scam for 8 months prior and had conducted 10 to 15 Bitcoin ATM transactions in the previous 6 months. She was already financially vulnerable with a fixed income and food and housing insecurity. APS, Adult Protection Services, had to become involved due to her dire circumstances, and she had been giving 50% of her income per month to the scammers. And she was afraid she was going to have to live out of her car because she had no money left. On November 24th, 2025, another victim had conducted four transactions within a period of approximately 90 minutes with a total loss of $15,000. One of those transactions was about $9,000. And the victim was directed to use various accounts that were in other pre-existing names. So the scammers have learned to circumvent the rules or the laws that were enacted in 24 so that they were no longer a new customer. They were considered an existing customer and thus not eligible for the refunds. That kiosk operator refused to provide a full refund because of that and would only provide a transaction fee refund. And we have also had multiple calls of victims actively at our Bitcoin ATMs. We have met with the gas station attendants and employees and have encouraged them to call when they do see this activity happening. And they called one day, and this victim was questioned by two fully uniformed officers, and she actually questioned if they were real. So that's showing the power these scammers have on these victims while they are being scammed. And ultimately, we were able to convince her that it was a scam and get her money returned to our bank. These incidences are not rare, and they are occurring weekly here in Minnesota. The current safeguards, warnings on the screens, daily limits, and refund provisions have not stopped this victimization. Scammers coach victims to ignore the warnings and to answer kiosk prompts in a way that bypasses these protections. Meanwhile, the kiosk operators continue to profit from these transactions. Cities that have tried to ban and restrict the kiosks have been met with lawsuits from multi-million dollar operators, and this is leaving local governments and police departments struggling to protect the residents while the businesses collect the revenue. We need stronger statewide action. This may include strictly restricting or severely restricting kiosk operations, requiring real-time identity verification or transaction holding periods, or removing the machines entirely. Our seniors, vulnerable adults, and hardworking families are being drained of their savings. If we don't act decisively, these losses are only going to grow. Our victims are often seniors, and the transactions are not a one-time thing. The financial impact on these victims is catastrophic, and generational wealth is leaving our communities at alarming rates. So thank you for your time and your commitment to protecting Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. Our next testifier is Larry Lipka, General Counsel for CoinFlip. Mr. Lipka, will you identify yourself for the record?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Larry Lipka. I'm the general counsel for CoinFlip. We are the largest kiosk operator in the world. We have over 50 kiosks here in Minnesota, and we're global and in almost every state in the U.S. I've testified before in Minnesota. We supported the bill that passed. At the time, we advised that further protection should be instituted because we didn't think the bill went far enough. But a couple things I want to address from the prior testimony. You know, we understand that there is a scam problem in the United States. It's not related to just kiosks. It's happening everywhere. It's gift cards. It's wire transfers. The scammers are vigilant. They're terrible, and they are stealing from Americans. No one here is saying that the kiosk operators themselves are the bad actors. It's the scammers. This is similar to what's happened in a lot of other financial products when they're new, like ATMs, traditional ATMs, credit cards, wire transfers, checks. The reaction has been not to ban these products when there is fraud happening, but to institute guardrails and safeguards. And there are a lot of things that I have advised that the state should pass, including blockchain analytics. You know, I've heard that the transactions are irreversible. You know, at CoinFlip, we have a hold period on new customer transactions so that there's a cooling off period. And I know that these tools work because we've got 8,000 customers in the state. There were 12,000 transactions that happened in the last year, and less than 1% of those were refund requests from customers. So I want to be clear that in the state of Minnesota already, you are protecting consumers because they get a full refund if they've been scammed. If there is an operator that is playing with that refund provision and not refunding people that they should be refunding, then the financial regulator should investigate them, fine them, and revoke their license. We are licensed entities in this state. It is inappropriate to ban a legal product because fraud is happening, not our fault. We want to work with everybody. And I just want to note that, you know, I understand the concern that law enforcement has, right? But when you are a hammer, all you see is nails. Law enforcement is not receiving calls from our 8,000 customers that use our product regularly to say, I had a wonderful transaction with CoinFlip. You can look on Google Maps to see reviews from customers who value our product because, one, we have 24-hour-a-day customer service. We are a physical product that brings crypto out of the cloud to the physical realm that makes it easy for people to buy crypto. You know, I've heard that people are losing lots and lots of money, but they should be requesting refunds because they can get a full refund. So I understand people are embarrassed to admit that they've been defrauded, but who here can say with a straight face that somebody who knows they can get a full refund for their transaction will not call the operator, submit a police report, and get a full refund? So I'm here today to say that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We should instead institute a very strict regulatory regime that includes if we need to change the definition of existing customer and new customer so that our other operators can't play this refund provision, let's do it. If we want to have refunds for everybody, let's do it. We should be using blockchain analytics. There should be 24-hour-a-day customer service for everybody in this industry. I know that the things that we do protect consumers because I worked for the Illinois Attorney General's office before I got into private practice. Our chief compliance officer is a former federal prosecutor, worked for Morgan Stanley for a very long time. We invest millions of dollars a year in employee salaries for consumer protection. We have spent millions of dollars on tools to prevent fraud. But if you ban this industry, the scams are not going away. The scammers will send people to unlicensed options. People will use gift cards. The gift card limit in this country is you can buy up to $10,000 in cash in one day. So the same scams that are happening with the Bitcoin ATMs will not just magically go away if you ban this product. They will go to other places where it is more difficult to stop those transactions. And with the blockchain, you can trace every single transaction. You can flag wallets that have been used for criminal activity in the past. These are all things that are not currently required in Minnesota, but other states have required it. Illinois is a very good example. We just passed a very good bill that the AARP agreed with, local law enforcement agreed with, the financial regulator agreed with. Maryland is another good example. Vermont is a very good example. There are a lot of blue states that have passed bills to regulate. There has not been a state that has banned this industry. So I urge everyone on this panel, whoever is a stakeholder, to come together. Let's do a working group, and let's improve on what the state has already done to protect consumers in the state. Thank you. And I'd love to answer any questions.
Yeah, I would stay close, Mr. Lipka, because I think there are going to be some questions for you.
But wonderful. I appreciate
that. Take
the
rest of our testimony and get through that. But, yeah, stay handy. I'm sure there are going to be questions for you. Final listed testifier is James Glass, a volunteer for AARP Minnesota. Mr. Glass, here we go. And after that, we'll be opening it up for other members in attendance today who would like to testify as well. So, Mr. Glass, will you identify yourself for the record?
I will. Thank you, Chairs Cagle and O'Donnell. O'Driscoll, I'm sorry, and all committee members. my name is Jim Glass. I'm a resident of Minneapolis and an AARP member and volunteer. My professional background is primarily in the banking industry, starting back in the 80s as a bank regulator, and then as a risk manager at a large national bank here in Minnesota. And to be honest, I've never seen anything that's taken off quite to the degree that this issue has. AARP has long worked to educate consumers, support fraud victims, and improve fraud detection and prevention, including providing free information to consumers through our Fraud Watch Network and Helpline. AARP also partners with local law enforcement, regulatory agencies, the Better Business Bureau, and the Attorney General's Office to host fraud prevention and awareness events. Volunteers across the state deliver fraud education and work directly with victims of fraud. Given my background in the banking industry and as a former regulator, I took an interest in this issue and really was quite blown away when I learned about the massive losses through scams involving crypto kiosks in our state. I'd like to share some of what I learned about this issue with you today. Some of you may not be all that familiar with cryptocurrency kiosks. However, These machines that look very similar to typical bank-sponsored cash machines are quickly becoming a preferred vehicle for scammers to move stolen, untraceable funds quickly from vulnerable seniors and others to a fraudster's account with little chance of recovery. However, instead of distributing cash like a traditional ATM, these machines take cash in exchange for digital cryptocurrency. Scammers prefer these kiosks because they eliminate the electronic tracking of funds that exist in normal financial transactions. By using kiosks, cash withdrawn from a bank by a victim is fed into a kiosk, then converted to cryptocurrency and sent to a digital wallet controlled by the scammer. This makes it nearly impossible to claw back the funds through traditional banking channels. In fact, attorneys general in both Iowa and District of Columbia found that more than 90% of kiosk transactions are tied to fraud, and that most scam victims are age 60 plus. That tells us this is not a misuse problem, it's a systemic one, and current safeguards are failing. These scams usually consist of two parts. First, a criminal contacts a potential victim and moves that person to a heightened emotional state of mind, sometimes over many months. Examples include identity theft scam, romance scam, or pretending to be the government. Once the scammer has their victim worried enough to feel that they must take some sort of immediate action or face dire consequences, they direct the victim to send the scammer money using local cryptocurrency kiosks. Criminals are known to give detailed instructions to their victims, including how to withdraw cash from their bank, locate a kiosk, and then use the kiosk to deposit cash to purchase and send them cryptocurrency in irreversible transfers. Criminals are becoming more sophisticated in their approach, which is making it even harder for individuals to detect fraud. As a result, criminals are more successful in their attempts, which is a growing challenge for law enforcement and policymakers who are trying to stay ahead of new scams. The impact of fraud on victims and their families is wide-reaching and can be financially and emotionally devastating, especially for older adults. I'm sure you can imagine the fear and shame that many of these victims feel, and I hope my testimony today stands in for many of the stories that I've heard in my time as an AARP volunteer. AARP Minnesota supported the legislature's efforts in 2024 to add needed consumer protections to these machines statewide. Fortunately, that legislation was signed into law, which now requires signage, disclosure of information like fees and receipts, refunds for new customers, and daily transaction limits for those who meet the definition of a new customer. Unfortunately, scammers have worked around these existing state laws to continue defrauding Minnesotans with these machines. The 2024 law was an important step forward, but we now know it's not enough to meet the scale and sophistication of this threat. Over the past 2 years, the evidence has become unmistakable. Cryptocurrency kiosks remain an easy and effective tool for criminals, and older adults are bearing the brunt of the harm. Across the country, communities are responding. Cities have worked to remove or ban these machines. The state legislature in Indiana recently sent a bill doing just that to their governor's desk. This growing momentum reflects a shared recognition that stronger action is needed. The legislature is right to take a second serious look at what is still happening here and how Minnesota's laws can truly protect older Minnesotans from devastating fraud. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this important issue, and thank you for all the good work that you guys do here.
Thank you, Mr. Glass. So it's my understanding that Sam Smith would like to testify on behalf of the Department of Commerce. Mr. Smith, identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair members. For the record, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Department of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to provide remarks on House File 3642, which proposes a ban on virtual currency kiosks in Minnesota. The department strongly supports House File 3642. In the coming days, the department will also present a broader consumer protection policy proposal that includes this ban as a key component. Virtual currency kiosks have become a growing vector for fraud, with the department, law enforcement, and local municipalities all seeing a sharp increase in scams involving these kiosks across Minnesota. Crypto kiosks resemble traditional ATMs and are often located in places like gas stations and grocery stores. Kiosk users insert cash or a debit card into the machine, pay a modest service fee, and then purchase cryptocurrency that the company typically inflates by 20 to 30% above market value. While it may be that some legitimate crypto investors are willing to overlook these very high fees in order to use cash to immediately have access to the crypto assets, these same factors make crypto kiosks an ideal intermediary to defraud their victims, leaving the victim with no recourse and no money. Most of us have received or know someone who has received an unsolicited email, text, or phone call that more than likely is part of a cryptocurrency scam or fraud. While the strategies these fraudsters use rely upon are constantly evolving, these schemes rely upon patiently developing trust, introducing a financial burden, and then requesting more and more money through the cryptocurrency obtained at a kiosk. When the fraudster has engaged in a romance scam, these financial losses can be emotionally devastating and embarrassing, leading many people to never report the fraud to local law enforcement or the Department of Commerce. Previous efforts to increase consumer protections for crypto kiosks have failed. The Minnesota legislature has already passed legislation to establish safeguards and consumer protections for the use of virtual currency and their kiosks here in Minnesota, which included licensing within the Commerce Department, disclosure of rules, anti-fraud measures. However, fraudsters have easily circumvented these new customer protections by instructing victims to make multiple small deposits, instructing their victims, often over the phone, on exactly what to click, bypassing kiosk warnings, disclosures, and new customer transaction limits, particularly by targeting the elderly or folks who are not tech savvy and pressuring them to ignore on-screen warnings. This is a growing problem. The Federal Bureau of Investigation estimates that Americans, many of them retirees, lost approximately $240 million to crypto kiosk-related scams in the first 6 months of 2025 alone. That's double the pace for similar scams in 2024. In Minnesota, the department has received 120 complaints over the last 3 years involving fraudulently induced transactions through crypto kiosks, totaling just under $1 million in reported losses. 2025 was the worst year on record, with 70 cases and $540,000 in losses already. While these numbers are significant, they only reflect the complaints that have been directed to us. The written testimony you have today from local law enforcement help gives a fuller picture of what's happening in Minnesota. While the department has successfully recovered funds for some victims, including $110,000 in 2025, fraudsters rely on crypto kiosks because it is so challenging to recover stolen money. Our data shows that only 48% of consumers receive any refund, and those refunds average just 16% of the original loss, with the average reported loss of $6,793. Cities such as Forest Lake, Stillwater, and St. Paul have presented proposals to ban crypto kiosks within their city jurisdiction due to widespread fraud and resident complaints. We believe the legislature should act to protect Minnesotans, especially seniors and other vulnerable and exploitable adults who are disproportionately targeted by these scams. I would add that Minnesota is not the only state currently considering a ban on crypto kiosks. Both the House and Senate have passed bans in Indiana, and the legislation is currently awaiting a signature from the governor. In conclusion, banning crypto kiosks will help protect consumers, support law enforcement, and local communities from financial exploitation. These kiosks make it far too easy for fraudsters to prey on vulnerable adults. However, it is important to note that this ban does not prohibit cryptocurrency itself. consumers will still have access to reputable online exchanges that offer significantly lower fees and safer transactions. Participation in crypto markets will remain possible, but in a way that minimizes risk and protects Minnesotans. Thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. You might want to stay handy as well. Okay. Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify or present here today? Not seeing any hands going up, we can move to discussion. Representative Ann Binsbergen, you're on the first one on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for bringing this bill. A couple just simple questions I have is, how long have these kiosks been in Minnesota? I'm a little unfamiliar to my territory and my district. So how long have they been in Minnesota? How many of them are there in Minnesota? And I know we talked a little bit, he briefly talked about total cost to Minnesota. What do we think the impact is annually in Minnesota? And are there companies that own these machines? Is that how these machines get out, so we know who the company owners of the kiosk machines are? And do they have a play in this? So those are some of my questions. I know that there's several of them, so.
Well, yeah, Mr. Smith did not get away from the podium that long, so he's going to take a stab at some of these.
Representative Chair, I apologize if I don't answer all the questions that you have, but the Department of Commerce, currently has a licensing role with crypto kiosks. There are hundreds of them across the states. They are owned by a variety of operators, not just the folks that testified or submitted written testimony today. And apologies, can you repeat the other questions you had?
So how long have we had these kiosks around the state? And what do we think the impact is annually in loss right here?
These, Representative Ann Binsberga, these kiosks have been operating the state for a number of years, I want to say like three or four, perhaps longer. Not sure of that off the top of my head. And it is difficult to accurately estimate the losses here in the state because any number that we have is likely an undercount due to an unwillingness by many folks to contact law enforcement or the Department of Commerce. As I said in my testimony, we are aware of over $1 million of reported crypto kiosk fraud losses just in terms of the complaints that have been reported to us. Looking at the written testimony from a couple local police departments, they each have seen losses on the order of magnitude of $500,000, and those are two relatively small municipalities. Looking at the national data, the FBI estimates that there have been over $240 million in crypto kiosk-related fraud loss nationally in the first 6 months of 2025. And so, well, I can't accurately kind of give you a precise number. I think these numbers, I think, taken together represent a staggering kind of fraud schemes being kind of processed via cryptocurrency kiosks.
And Mr. Chair.
Follow-up question?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Chair Cagle.
Thank you. And so I stopped at a gas station a few weeks back, ran in to grab some gum and a pop. And as I was there was one of these crypto kiosks right next to me. And they look like off-brand ATMs. And they're kind of just, stuck in a corner and anybody can use them, and so they really are kind of just appearing everywhere, and I've seen them in a lot of the gas stations in my area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. So how many, from the department, how many of these kiosks are there? I mean, we should know that number, right?
Mr. Chair, I think if the department could pull those registration licenses, we could get that information to you.
Okay. Thank you.
We're laying the bill over, so we can accumulate questions that we can follow up on. So, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could the officer from Woodbury come back up, and also the gentleman, the lawyer from the, apparently it's an association. I don't know what
that would be. Lynn Lawrence and Larry Lipka.
Yes, please.
And Mr. Chair, I do have an answer to the number of kiosks.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair. He can answer that real quick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Spinbergen, as of today, as far as we know, there are 350 cryptocurrency kiosks licensed and operating in Minnesota by 8 to 10 operators. Whether that reflects the total number of kiosks, I couldn't speak to that.
Yes. One last question.
Mr. Chair.
Are there some operators that aren't licensed?
Mr. Smith?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Van Spinbergen, and it's certainly possible that there are crypto kiosks that have been placed without licensure, but, okay. You know, that's I can't speak to that.
Thanks. Thank you.
You're good? Okay, now we can go to Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and first of all, to the officer, I really want to thank the City of Woodbury for allowing you to investigate these terrible situations. I cannot believe where these machines are located. I think Cub Foods should throw them out. That's a very convenient place for people to be, and I think that Cub Foods is one of them. I know that some of the gas stations have them in Rosemount. I've heard horror stories. We heard them again today. But, officer, when you investigate these, how are they different from investigating maybe something that happens at an ATM?
That's a very good question. When we are investigating these cryptocurrency cases that we get, the money moves very, very quickly. We do have some tracing tools that our department has allowed us to purchase so that we can try to trace those funds and see where they go, but they just move so fast that trying to get any money back for the victims is very, very difficult. And to identify who the suspects are is also very difficult. A regular ATM type case, that's usually run through, you know, a bank, and we can do search warrants, get bank records, follow the money, actually identify account holders, and proceed with the investigation that way.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And thank you, officer. That's kind of where I wanted to head on. And then I'm just curious offhand, this will be the last question for you, is how many of these crimes, do you see much coming across state lines, or is Wisconsin more lenient with this than we are? What do you see there, because you're kind of a border city?
That's another fantastic question. So since Minnesota did enact the laws in 2024, we are having some customers who are, or victims rather, who are being directed to go across the border, knowing that Wisconsin does not carry the same laws currently that Minnesota does. So that is definitely a concern and an issue that we are seeing.
Thank you, officer, and thank you for your service. The attorney for the group here, how many banks have these? Is there any banks that put crypto machines in them? I'm sure you'd probably know that question.
So I can't be 100% for the entire industry, but I would say that would be very unusual for a bank to have one of these crypto kiosks. We are a direct competitor to banks. People buy crypto in general is. People take cash out of their bank and then buy crypto with it. So certainly banks do not like us and would not let us in there. But we are in places that are convenient, right? So I think we're here saying today that it's bad that this product is convenient. That to me is incorrect, because a product that is convenient is obviously one that is liked by customers. And if you look at the Google Map reviews for our kiosks, most of our customers do flag that they use our product because it is fast, convenient, and easy. We have 24-hour day customer service, and we are the only way to buy crypto with cash. So for people who are unbanked or who don't have identification, this is the only way for them to participate in the digital economy. That is the value proposition of this product. So if kiosks are banned, people who transact in cash cannot buy crypto in any other way.
Mr. Chair, I just want to curry the time up, and I appreciate his answer. But I think that one of the things I'm getting at here, and this is more of a statement now, is us as a legislator have banned certain devices, such as cigarette machines that were all over when I was a kid, but you can't find one in the state right now. Sometimes this is how we have to protect our most vulnerable. In the cigarette ban, we did that because of children that were able to walk up and buy a pack of smokes. This one here, we have our most vulnerable people living on a fixed income, getting, and again, terrible actors. I know you're the hammer, but sometimes we have to regulate the hammer, too, the tool in this. And that's where I think we may have some disagreement with you on it, at least I do, about where these things should be located. Because, again, I had a family member who had been taking advantage of this. So that's just a statement, members, and I yield back to the chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Next questioner is Representative Buck.
Thank you, Chair. This one's for Woodbury PD. How much time do you spend, your officers spend, investigating these kind of crimes versus other crimes?
So currently we have one detective who is primarily doing crypto investigations, and I would say he spends probably 90% of his time doing strictly crypto-related cases.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Is that it? Okay. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is for Mr. Smith, and I'll preface it by saying I think that it's fair to say in Minnesota that we really value freedom. And so I hope that, you know, this is a bipartisan effort to address fraud while protecting also those folks that do value this option. And so my question, Mr. Smith, would be, in your testimony, you were talking briefly about other avenues that would be utilized and that are even currently utilized by fraudsters, whether that be gift cards or other options that can be used online. You even suggested that the costs are lower, which I checked, and 100%, yes, you can get a better deal if you're not, you know, in a convenient location or what have you. What is your experience, Mr. Smith, in recovering funds that have utilized those options as opposed to a kiosk? Is there tools available in those instances that aren't available at a kiosk? And I think that even Mr. Lubka had suggested that there have been efforts to try to bring more of those tools to the kiosk. But if you could address specifically how that looks in terms of recovery and investigation for the other online and what have you, those options, what that looks like, and if it's easier, how so.
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, thank you for the question. And absolutely, crypto kiosks are not the only way that fraudsters are operating in Minnesota. And gift card-based frauds represent, I think, another alarming kind of strategy that fraudsters are using to separate vulnerable people from their money. I think one meaningful difference between fraud that is being conducted through a crypto kiosk instead of a gift card scam is that most are not cash transactions, and that when a credit card is used, for instance, chargeback and refunds can occur in a way that can oftentimes be more difficult with a cryptocurrency kiosk. So I think that's a meaningful difference, but I don't mean by saying that to suggest that it isn't a serious problem that we investigate in our enforcement division.
Continue.
Right, so I appreciate that answer, but I did see Mr. Lubka with maybe a look that indicated he had a response. I'd like to hear,
sure,
if that's okay.
Thank you. So, under federal law, there's Reg E, which requires financial institutions to refund unauthorized transactions. So that is when somebody steals your credit card or hacks into your bank account. That is because the financial institution did something wrong, or, you know, Walgreens didn't check your ID when the scammer was using your credit card. Under federal law, you do not need to refund authorized transactions. So what you're talking about for a gift card purchase, if somebody buys a gift card, whether it's a credit card or cash, sends it to a scammer, the credit card company will not refund that amount because they are not required to under federal Reg E. The kiosk industry, in particular my company, we refund scam victims the fees regardless of whether we're required to under law. Under state law in Minnesota, we are required to refund the full amount. We are the only financial services product in the entire United States, I think globally, that needs to refund authorized transactions. An authorized transaction is, unfortunately, where somebody sends crypto or sends money to a scam victim. So for our industry, we already have a bespoke refund requirement that protects consumers more vigorously than credit cards, than exchanges. And I do just want to note that the overall crypto fraud in this country last year, cited by the FBI, was $3 billion. So we're talking about 3% of the total fraud at the kiosks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Heintzman,
you can... Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just comment. I appreciate the testimony. Mr. Smith, I don't know that I heard a real answer to my question, whether it's necessarily a process that is comparable or that we had numbers specifically that could give us some assurance that by fixing, quote unquote, eliminating, I guess, would be a more, I think, accurate way of saying access to this technology would make fraud go away. I hope that this committee would be pursuing legislation that would actually get at the underlying tools that are being used in such a way that we fix the problem instead of taking away the opportunity for those that do benefit from this technology and the convenience of having it available. And I don't think impugning businesses for providing a service to their customers is the right way to do it. Bringing up an individual business chain and saying, I think that we should get rid of that, that business shouldn't be doing that, isn't probably productive. I think the productive path would be to mimic those states who have had success in providing law enforcement the tools to really help those that have been defrauded. Just my two cents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers and to the gentleman. I'm sorry, can I get the name again?
Yeah, Larry Lipka.
Lipka. Thank you, Mr. Lipka. So just a quick statement. It's very early in this, and I hear all this. Any action we take at the legislature at this point in juncture will be wrong. We're going to get it wrong one way or the other. Here's what I did not hear today, and I'm offering this up. We can't go into this with a combative sense of the testifiers against us. We're, you know, our tools are very, very limited. It's going to be a bad piece of legislation that's going to do bad outcomes that people are going to figure out how to get around. What I needed to hear, what I would like to hear going forward is your company and this industry, you have far more tools than we have. You have far more algorithms. You have far more ways to fight this than forcing us into a situation where a decision will be made to ban something or regulate it. So what I would like to hear, and I hope then coming forward, and maybe it's just a matter of time, is tell me how the companies are working with law enforcement. What tools are you putting together? What dollars are you spending? Because you can get way ahead of this way quicker than we can. This is coming. We know that. I understand that. I'm certainly not one. I hear Representative Hewitt on the analogy of the cigarette machines, but the fact of the matter is we haven't solved the cigarette problem either. It's just new ways. So what I keep talking to companies about is you're offering a service. There's a cost of doing business. Figure out how to use the tools that are available to you because you have far more than we do to solve these problems and to make sure we minimize this. There will always be buyer beware. There will always be those problems. But you can be far more benevolent than we can. So that's what I would offer up to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's one thing I appreciate about Representative Kreisha is he's always thinking those kinds of questions that I'm usually thinking about as well. But he puts them so much more eloquently, and with his experience, he puts
it. I just want to get to breakfast, Mr. Chair.
So I guess my mine's just going to be a comment more than anything else. I appreciate the testifiers coming forward. I would echo a lot of the same comments that Representative Kreisha had in that particular case to the committee. I would point out there's a letter in your packets from the city of Faribault. I got really interested in the whole cryptocurrency situation, specifically because of what I'd heard for comments made by my police department in Faribault and Chief Sherwin. Since 2022, they were able to show they'd had close to $500,000 worth of reported cryptocurrency monies that had been lost. And statistically, if you look back at the numbers, 25%, that's only 25% of what typically gets reported. It is an incredibly embarrassing thing to have happen to people. I can't imagine, and like they pointed out, they just had horror story after horror story, and the amount of time their police department has to dedicate solely to trying to investigate this and claw back money is really sad. I mean, if 25% is only reported out of $500,000, that's $2 million that's left a rural community like mine. Those dollars could have been turning there in that community. They could have been doing a lot of good with the tax increases, probably pay their property tax bills. But it's one of those things that it's devastating to a lot of people when this happens, especially when we have retirees and people living on fixed incomes, and they're given false hope through scammers. So thank you for the bill being brought forward. Thank you for the constructive conversation, and I would really appreciate hearing some of the responses to Representative Kreisha's questions. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Next up is Representative Falconer.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank Representative Cagle and Perryman for bringing this bill forward. There just seems to be a lot of problems here. Quick search while we're having this discussion on CNN outlining how, Iowa Attorney General suing CoinFlip and Bitcoin. The internet is just replete with examples of fraud scams, Arizona, Montana, Idaho, Texas. Like has already been mentioned, I think by Mr. Smith, $240 million across the country was scammed as of October of last year. And as Representative Allen pointed out, if that's only 25% of what's reported, that potentially could be $1 billion across the country. Companies are making millions in profits off of these things. It really seems like these kiosks aren't meant for prime time. The safeguards aren't there. People are being frauded. Our seniors in particular are losing life savings. I guess there's just one question, because the account from the, and I'm sorry, I forget his name, the legal representation. He kind of cavalierly said that, why are they bothering with police reports? Just file a refund or whatever. But cavalierly said, just ask for a refund. But then if 16% is returned in the average refund, and if somebody lost $80,000, they're only getting $12,000 back, and they're out, the other amount. So I'm just wondering, what's the response to the reality on the ground of, if it's 16% returned, but the company's saying just ask for a refund, we give it all back, but the margins of your profits would seem to indicate you are kind of dependent on the fraud to take in this money, given the margins for what your profit making is. So we're just kind of discordant there in the two stories. So I'd like a response from one or probably both of you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So in Minnesota, new customers, which is your first couple transactions, your state law mandates a full refund. So not just the transaction fee, the full amount. So that is a loss to the crypto company if they have completed that transaction, because we have lost the crypto and then we have to refund the victim. At CoinFlip, we hold new customer transactions for a length of time for a cooling off period, so that customer, not only are they entitled to that refund, they also can get the the crypto back or the money back because we haven't completed that transaction. Okay. In addition, we have a voluntary fee refund for anybody who falls outside of that new customer period and wants a refund, and that is on our website. So we do that voluntarily because we do not want to profit off of scam victims. It is the right thing to do. So my point is that the Department of Commerce should be regulating the licensed operators. If they are not refunding the full amount like they're required to under state law, then they should be fined and or their license should be revoked.
Representative Smith. Oh, no. Oh, sorry, Sam Smith.
No relation.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, we certainly appreciate and value that there are full refund protections for new customers at a crypto kiosk. I would only note that there is really clear evidence that the fraudsters are able to circumvent these new customer protections by coaching or guiding their victims to use an existing wallet or customer identification number. And so while these protections are valuable, I think it's safe to say that they are not adequate to the sophistication of the fraudsters that are currently operating here in Minnesota and across the country.
Representative Falconer.
All right, thank you for that. Yeah, and I think that's evident too. I mean, in one of the stories that CNN had, they had a video transcript and I was able to just read the written transcript of the interaction of a police officer who was trying to stop a woman from feeding money in. The fraudster was on either on the phone or, you know, I can't watch it because we're here right now. But it was clear that, like you just said, that the fraudsters are setting up people to send money to an already verified account. Once that money's there, it's gone. It would fall out of the new customer refunds. I can't imagine you're just magnanimously giving back $80K because somebody says it went somewhere else. I mean, these machines just aren't ready to be out in the wild. I don't think the protections aren't there from the industry itself. When our law enforcement and our agencies have trouble trying to track down money that has gone overseas, it's gone into a mysterious system that's designed specifically to be the opposite of transparent. This is just ripe for fraud, as is evidenced by the 240 documented $1 million, potentially up to $1 billion across the country, and millions of that in the state of Minnesota. So thank you again for bringing this bill forward again. These need to be taken out of our state, I think.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the City of Woodbury Police Department for making this a priority for the city and taking lead on this. My question is, what's the maximum withdrawal from these ATM kiosk machines? Is it 1,000, 10,000, 20,000? What kind of cash is being withdrawn from these machines is my question.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My understanding is that they're putting cash into the machines. I don't know how much that they can purchase at a time. Maybe Mr. Smith knows that. But what's happening is people are going to their banks and taking money out of the bank. And so I would assume that they're, to avoid being caught, that they would go under the threshold for suspicious activity and then feed that into a crypto kiosk.
And is this more like an international crime syndicate, do you think, that's happening, this fraud? Or is this more like domestic, where this money's going?
Well, I would recognize that, you know, it could be used for a number of things. You know, it could be used to fund cartels in Mexico. You know, we just don't know. And I think that's the key thing, is that there's no way to track this cryptocurrency like there is, you know, cash or credit card. I mean, you can even, you know, the cash has serial numbers. You can track cash. And so I think that's just where we are right now, is that there's no way to track this. And as we heard yesterday, it makes people vulnerable to theft and even kidnapping and assault. You know, we've heard horror stories of, you know, it happened right here in Minnesota with the guy, you know, in Lake Minnetonka. And so, you know, we're going to continue to work on this. But I think, you know, right now the technology has so much outpaced us that if we could just take a breath and figure out how we can regulate this industry and track the currency. Because to me, a currency that you can't track doesn't seem to be meant for anything upstanding. There are people who use it, you know, as an alternative to banking. And, you know, we've also heard from credit unions that they'd like to be repositories for these. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of opportunities for us to be able to put guardrails up. And, you know, you can still go on your phone to CoinFlip's app and purchase cryptocurrency there. And so we're not taking away the opportunity to purchase crypto. It's just making it a little bit more difficult to scam people.
Representative Chow.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for those remarks. I'm going to take the conversation offline, but you know, thanks for bringing this bill forward because I know personally people in my family who has been at the end of this romance scam, big butchering, and people who have refinanced their mortgages who've lost over $100,000 personally into this type of kiosk stuff. So thank you so much. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Next up is Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Chair. Members, thank you for presenting this bill. Kind of an off-the-cuff question would be, with these horrible fraudsters, is there any way that they can go after even the more most vulnerable individuals that are using subsidy, public subsidy cards, and extract funds off of those public subsidy cards? Has that been a result in the past? Have you seen any results of that taking place?
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm assuming if there are subsidies that go into a bank account, then that can be taken out of a bank account and put into a crypto kiosk. And so if you are having, you know, your monthly benefits deposited into a bank or a credit union, that's fair game then.
Other testifier, do you have any other records on that at all?
Do you have any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Smith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. In terms of the crypto kiosk itself, you know, they will only accept cash, you know, typically in the form of paper currency, but perhaps a debit card depending upon the kiosk. And so you wouldn't be able to directly kind of siphon off other kind of sources of income that an individual might have, but I'm not aware of any kind of direct evidence of that concern, but you know, certainly worth investigating further.
Thank you.
Done. Okay. Representative Perryman.
Yes, if you guys would bear with me, Sergeant Latz, thank you, Chair. Sergeant Latz, if he'd come up, we've been talking about the refunding and that they're getting a lot back. Talking to my sergeant, I think I would love to have him explain what he has experienced in the refunding. And Sergeant Latz, if anything else you can add of questions that maybe you have experienced firsthand.
Sure. So in terms of the refunds from the transactions themselves, like I stated earlier in my testimony, over half of our transactions are falling outside of the window for reimbursement for new accounts. And as was previously testified to, many of these scammers now, when they're contacting people and directing them to the kiosk, they're providing information on existing accounts, which our statute doesn't apply to. So although the companies do have those protections for new customers in place, the vulnerable folks that are being victimized are not necessarily being directed to create a new account that would have those safeguards in place. So it is very uncommon for us to recover the funds through these transactions because they're so fractured and hard to track for us. And then when it comes to what the companies offer for safeguards, the majority of these cases fall outside of those, so they're not eligible for them. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I thank you. Thank you. So,
real quick, if I can go.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I can't Can't recognize Woodbury and not recognize our great city, the Granite City, is that what it's called? St. Cloud for putting this investment forward. And officer, thank you for your hard work in protecting our citizens.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Okay, and with that, I think we're bringing it home right now. So Representative Co-Chair O'Driscoll, you have some questions or remarks, and then we'll turn it back over to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one question for one of our members, and then I'll just make some brief comments to kind of help underscore the conversation for today. I was wondering if Representative Faulkner would yield to a question.
Representative Faulkner.
Yeah, let's go.
I love the drama. the drama is like, well, no, members don't usually ask other members questions. What's going on here?
It feels like a trap, but let's jump.
Not a trap. It is absolutely not a trap. I'll assure you of that. It's a clarification. Did you earlier say reference CNN?
Yes.
Is that the crypto news network? I'm just wondering how long that joke would go before it got stale. Apparently, we're still in pretty good shape. But with this is really not a laughing and joking matter. It's a very serious matter. And Representative Allen, we'll be bringing another bill forward, members, that we will have some time on this. Mm-hmm. We have agreed with our DFL counterparts and as a team, both Democrats and Republicans on here, that we are going to look to find ways to protect consumers and affordability for Minnesotans. And this issue falls squarely in both of those camps. If you have the seniors who are being defrauded and they're taking money and they're taking their savings in good faith because they may have received some information, and those scams, the scams are the same. It's the vehicles in which the scammers use. Yeah. They used to be calling people and saying, Grandma, I need money. My car broke down. Can you send money? I'm afraid to talk to Mom and Dad about this. Remember those scams that were going on? Right? Same thing. Hey, Grandma, I need you to go to the cryptocurrency machine. I need you to put money in and send me money. As unfortunate as the Nancy Guthrie case is right now, a lot more people have figured out and have been exposed to the issue of currency if they've been, or cryptocurrency, if they've been watching the news and the issues that are associated with that. And I'm going to encourage all players to work in good faith to come to a solution on this, because you've heard the testifiers and you've heard the members of this committee. We're very concerned about protecting consumers in this arena, in an area that a lot of folks don't know anything about. They understand greenbacks in their wallet, but they don't understand this cryptocurrency kind of a thing that they can learn about on apparently the CNN network, as we established earlier. But again, to everyone involved, Democrats and Republicans want a solution to this, and we'll be working in this committee to attempt to get that solution by the end of session this year. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Madam Chair, any closing comments?
Representative, I can't really echo anything more than what Chair O'Driscoll said. You know, I think the point is that we really do want to make sure that we're protecting Minnesotans. We know that this is a sophisticated area that, like, who knows what crypto is anyway? Like, what is it? It's a blockchain somewhere hidden in a data center? Like, I just don't get it anyway. And so, you know, we want to make sure that there's good guardrails in place before we let these folks into our state. And so I would say, like, let Wisconsin be the guinea pigs. We can, you know, learn from them after all the good enforcement goes in place. And so, you know, I really appreciate the good faith effort to work together on this. And I've, you know, I'm excited to see Representative Allen's bill as well and figure out ways where we can incorporate more protections for Minnesotans in this arena of crypto. So with that, I will renew my motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Okay. And with that, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Perryman.
Chair Cagle said everything, and I think there's a lot of stakeholders. I believe there's a lot of stakeholders in this room, and we're all respectful to one another, and we will come with a solution. I love how Chair O'Driscoll is very adamant that we will have a great bill to protect what everyone said today by the end of the session. So believe in the session, believe in us, and I know we'll get things done together in this room.
Okay, and then with that House File 3642 is amended, is laid over for further discussion.
Thank you. Next up on the agenda is House File 2700.
Second here.
Oh, here we go. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I don't know what they did with it. I think I might have a lot of them. I was. Did they get rid of them?
Start just like. One second.
All right. Representative Elkins, would you like to move your bill 2700 to Judiciary?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right. And I understand there is an amendment?
Two amendments? I think there are two amendments, but okay. I'd like to just give an overview of the bill before offering the amendments, if I could.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead. Yeah.
So, The purpose of this bill is intended to fill in kind of a gap in our current data privacy laws as related to health. So if we're talking about data like electronic health records or health claims data, all of that kind of data has long been protected under the under HIPAA or and HITECH or the Minnesota Health Records Act. But in general, there are protections that would cover health data in the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act as well. But we've got a gap in protecting the data that is collected from our wearable devices or applications that we might use. Like a prominent one might like be many women use a menstrual cycle tracker, for example, which has been in the news. So there was a reason why I raised that one. So the purpose of this bill is to plug that gap by classifying this type of health data as a class of sensitive data under the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act. The primary effect of classifying data as sensitive data is that it changes that data from being data that you have to opt out of allowing to be shared or sold into data that your prior authorization is required before that data can be shared or sold. And the nature of this data typically in the most typical use cases is that the data is more often shared rather than sold per se. So a typical use case would be, say, your doctor wants to keep track of, atrial fibrillation or some condition, and so you would consent to having the data from your Apple Watch shared directly with your provider through Epic. And there's an existing application programming interface to allow that. But it's the kind of thing that you would want the patient should grant their prior approval. It should not be assumed that this is going to be permissible. So what this bill does is basically say if a consumer's data of this nature is going to be shared or sold, then it requires the patient's advance approval. Okay. So the bill adds a couple of definitions to the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act, including the definition of the health data that would be covered under this. The concept of sharing as opposed to sale, and we discussed the nature of this data is that it is more commonly shared rather than sold, so we need a definition of shared. And then the other important new concept in here is that of geofencing. So I think we talked a little bit about geographic tracking with Representative Cagle's surveillance bill last week. So with respect to health data, I think we would want to, we wouldn't want people putting a geofence around the office of our urologist or gynecologist or mental health provider and have that data used to to create tracked advertising tracking, on us for that. So in the comment letters, there's one from the online advertising agents business, says, well, we want to be able to serve you up ads. If you're going to TRIA for orthopedic care, we'd like to know that you're there so that we can serve you up ads related to orthopedic tennis shoes. Well, how would you feel if we just flipped out that example and said, okay, we can see that you're visiting your urologist. We'd like to serve you up ads for Viagra and Flomax. Or they can see that you're visiting a mental health clinic and they want to serve you up ads for Prozac. I think for most of us, that would creep us out. So that's the reason for putting in the restrictions on geofencing. And those are the main use cases. So a famous case that would have come up with this is that as recently as in September, Google and Flow Health had to pay a settlement of $56 million because they had, it was a California case, but because they had promised the users of their application, which women use to track their periods, that they would not sell or share the data, and then they did. So this is a perfect example of why we need this legislation. I think the other definition in the bill that is probably going to leave some heads scratching, so I'll just address it right now. In the definition of health data, hold on a second here. There's one part of that definition that is really hard to read. Why am I having trouble finding it? Probably because it had a post sticky over it. Well,
Representative Elkins, do you want to move the amendments?
Yeah, let's go ahead and move the two amendments. So the one amendment, let's get them straight. The A1 amendment just straightens out the date. When the bill was introduced, it was with a 2025 effective date. This would just change the effective date to 2026 for these provisions. And there was one other place where there was a 2029 date, and it just changes it to 2030. So it's a very technical amendment.
Any discussion to the A4 amendment? Or I'm sorry, the A1 amendment.
A1, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay.
All right. Would you like to offer the A4 now?
Yeah, the A4 amendment. I have to apologize for this because most of the comments that you're seeing in the letters are related to these language. This is no excuse. I did point out that When we screwed up in high school, Father Harris would ask us for an excuse, and when we gave our usually lame rationalization, he would observe to us that I asked you for an excuse and you gave me a reason. So I don't have an excuse for these mistakes, but I got too many rods in the fire. I did not vet the language that is affected by the A4 amendment, so I'm just taking that language out. It doesn't need to be in this bill. It might be reincarnated in a different bill. I'm planning to bring forward a bill soon. I'm working with the Attorney General's office, their data privacy team, on another bill that would just be a technical cleanup bill, and revised language of this nature might end up on that bill. But I'm not going to bring back these sections of language that are being deleted as part of this bill going forward.
Thank you. So Representative Elkins moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay.
All right. Now, would you like to bring up your testifiers?
Yes. I have no testifiers of my own, but I think there are testifiers that are on the list.
So we have one testifier on the list, a virtual testifier. If you could unmute yourself, turn on your video, Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record, we have William Martinez on the line.
Good morning, everyone. Can you see and hear me?
We can. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is William Martinez, and I serve as counsel to the State Privacy and Security Coalition. SPSC is a New England-based multi-sector coalition of more than 30 companies and seven trade associations. We work with legislators across the country to develop data privacy frameworks that protect consumers, drive consensus among stakeholders, and promote interoperability across the states. We're actually very proud to be part of the process that helped Minnesota enact its comprehensive data privacy law. Now, at the outset, I want to make clear that we are not in opposition to stronger protections for consumer health data. We agree that information about someone's physical or mental health or diagnosis deserves heightened protections. Our main concern, however, is that the bill blends two very different approaches: Connecticut's provisions on consumer health data and Washington State's My Health, My Data Act. Now, the problem is that those laws were built in very different contexts. Connecticut's health data protections were built into a comprehensive privacy law that already defined processing, consent, and mechanisms for enforcement. Washington's law, on the other hand, was enacted as a standalone statute, so it uses broader definitions and more prescriptive authorization requirements because it had to create a new novel framework. Now, when those two models are laid on top of each other, they create overlap and confusion. This is why we're not working with Representative Elkins on potential amendments to the bill to better align it with Connecticut on consumer health data. And we did submit written testimony, but I do want to highlight two quick areas of concern. First is the definition of health data. As written, the bill covers inferred and predictive data, including proxy or extrapolated information. In practice, this can sweep in everyday consumer activity that doesn't necessarily reveal medical condition. Buying vitamins, fitness equipment, or certain foods could be treated as health data, even if there's no actual diagnosis or treatment involved or identified. Connecticut takes a more narrow approach. It focuses on data used to identify someone's physical or mental health condition or receipt of care. So the Connecticut model keeps protection strong but targeted. And the second issue I want to highlight is the bill's separate definition of sharing. Because Minnesota's existing privacy law already regulates processing and provides a definition of sale, adding a new sharing category risks duplicative consent prompts and confusion when extra authorization is required. Too many layered consent requirements can overwhelm consumers and make consent less meaningful and not more privacy protective. Again, we believe Minnesota can strengthen protection for sensitive health information without importing pieces of a standalone law that was never designed to operate within a comprehensive privacy law. Again, we look forward to continuing to work with the representative and the committee to make changes to the bill that can establish heightened protections for consumer health data while preserving the structure of Minnesota's existing law. Thank you all for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Is there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. So discussion to the bill 2700 as amended.
Oh, and Madam Chair, can I respond quickly to this testimony?
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I just want to say that I've had a constructive working relationship with the organization that Mariner works on behalf, and I've already started exchanging ideas with them about how to make improvements to the bill as it moves forward. Mariner and the client that they represent knows that that I will continue to work with them going forward on further amendments to the language. I've always had a very trusting and cooperative relationship with the organization, which is kind of the main organization now that is representing the tech business community.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any other further discussion to the bill? No? Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know the intention is to move this out of committee, and I just want to let members know that the primary topic area in this bill is within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. because it touches up a little bit against the health insurance-related things. That's why it's here. Yeah. Chair Scott is also a co-author on this bill. She's also the co-chair of Judiciary. It would be most appropriate to have that close nexus with the chair and the author of this bill to work out the details on this. So members, the bill needs some work. We all recognize that, but we're going to, as a courtesy, move it to a jurisdiction where they have committee jurisdiction, and the chief author and the number two author will work together to deal with the questions at that point about data practices and data privacy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Elkins, any wrap up?
No, I think everything needs to be said as it's been said at this point. So I'd like to renew the motion to advance this bill to the Judiciary Committee.
All right. Representative Elkins renews his motion to refer House File 3615 as amended to... Okay.
2700.
Sorry, 2700. Mm-hmm. My script is, maybe I can't read. Representative Elkins renews his motion that 2700 as amended go to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Next on the calendar is, that's where it is. House File 3615. Rep. Hansen. Welcome, Representative Hansen, if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. House File 3615 is a very simple bill that's going to provide a modicum of support for small businesses in Minnesota that have led the nation in the THC beverage and low-dose edible market. This bill simply changes the date on an in-state testing requirement from January 1st of 2026 to March 1st of 2027. For some background and for those who may have missed it, the 2018 Farm Bill nationally legalized and defined hemp, which kicked off the interstate commerce of products with THC derived from hemp plants. This launched a national hemp-derived THC product market that has grown into a $28 billion industry. Minnesota launched a nation-leading regulatory framework and empowered many local businesses to pioneer the way to becoming among the most successful in the nation. THC beverage brewers, saved many breweries here in Minnesota from otherwise going under in a very crowded alcohol market. The industry is largely made up of very successful small businesses, many of which are based right here in Minnesota and are widely loved. On November 12, 2025, however, Senator Mitch McConnell successfully spearheaded an effort that will decimate the flourishing small business market that he and the federal government themselves initiated not even a decade earlier. The changes go into effect in November of 2026, and without more changes, the end of the national THC beverage and low-dose edible market is just around the corner. So despite being wildly successful, profitable, and supported by consumers from coast to coast, the elimination of an interstate market is fatal for most of these businesses. These businesses now face a dark and hopeless future that is seemingly resting in the hands of Representative Emmer, so please let him know if you like THC beverages. And many Minnesota businesses fear that they will not make it if the federal government doesn't make a change. So while we hope that the federal government remembers that these small businesses are the lifeblood of our economy, the bill before us today is the least that we can do here in Minnesota to support these local small businesses in the meantime. So again, this bill simply changes the last paragraph of 342.61 in Subdivision 1, which regulates the testing requirements of lower potency hemp edibles and hemp-derived consumer products here in Minnesota. The original statute required that the testing of these products must be done in-state as of January 1st of 26. However, the testing market in Minnesota is still developing. It's leaving limited access to in-state testing at this time. House File 3615 changes that effective date for this in-state testing requirement from that January 1st to March 1st of 27 to allow the market more time to deliver more testing capacity for businesses while they wait to learn if the federal government will correct course or not. If they don't, these businesses will be federally prohibited from sending their product out of state for testing as of November 12, 2026. So this 3/1/27 date leaves us some wiggle room for whatever decision the feds arrive at and for us to come back next session and make any adjustments that we need. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Chair.
Thank you. We do have a testifier on deck, director from the Office of Cannabis Management, Director Tolble. Sorry. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Eric Tolble. I'm the director for the Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management. Here today to testify in support of Representative Hansen's bill, mostly for the reasons that Representative Hansen laid out. We think it's a smart piece of legislation that addresses a real issue that Minnesota businesses are facing and alleviates concerns, especially for businesses that are dealing with some substantial federal ambiguity. From our lens, the thing that I think is most important about this piece of legislation is that it's time-bound, and so it gives the industry until the end of next session to sort of, one, see what happens federally with the definition of hemp and whether or not the hemp market persists sort of in any form or fashion, and then two, to the extent that it does exist in some form or fashion moving forward, this body will have a chance next legislative session to sort of react to or respond to any potential federal changes to address, assist, support what remains of the hemp industry here in Minnesota. I think by and large, we think the design principles this body came up with when it instituted the in-state testing requirements were a good policy choice. Nationwide, cannabis testing runs the gamut from sort of not great at all to very great, and a lot of that depends on the regulatory structure set in various states. Because cannabis markets are intrastate markets only, given the federal illegality of cannabis. And I think ultimately for us, we see this as a way to, as Representative Hansen suggested, provide some support to the hemp industry here in Minnesota that is currently trying to make business decisions about what they'll do for the next 6-9 months and into the future while the federal government works on these issues. The other thing this piece of legislation does, which is really helpful and important, is it'll help alleviate some current bottlenecks at the two licensed testing facilities in Minnesota. Currently, they're testing both hemp and cannabis products. Many, I think, smart, forward-looking hemp businesses are moving their testing from out-of-state to in-state to get towards compliance that will be required once they're licensed on or about April 1st of this year. With this moving forward and allowing for this change, we would definitely be able to see a lot of that hemp product testing be moved out of state, which would help increase turnaround times at those two licensed testing facilities here in the state. So certainly we support it, and I'm also happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Not having any other testifiers signed up, is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify on this issue? Going once, going twice, don't see anybody? Great. Well, we will move to member discussion. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill. I'm happy to co-author it, and I hope it flies out of here no problem. I do have a question for the director. Testing has been an issue. If you talk to anybody in the industry, they will talk to you about not getting product or not being able to get product tested. We have two labs in Minnesota, but turns out one of them may not be so great, so there's effectively one lab, and we're still waiting on new ones to be licensed. Over the last couple months, there was one lab in particular, Phyto Lab, put out the following statement on their website, and I'm just going to read a tiny part of it because it is rather vulgar. Due to unclear and inconsistent information from the Office of Cannabis Management, Phyto Lab is no longer providing cannabis testing services of any kind. If you are interested in getting your product tested, good, fill in the blank, luck. The OCM has proved themselves to be fully incompetent to regulate this market, and we're not interested nor in a place to help them fix it. That's from somebody trying to get licensed as a lab in Minnesota. So my question is, has anything been addressed of their concerns? And what is the status of getting more labs online? Because two labs, almost one lab, is going to be disastrous for people trying to get in this market.
Director.
Chair, Representative West, thank you for the question. I won't speak directly to the specifics of the individual application, just because some of the data is non-public data as it relates to application materials. What I can tell you, though, broadly about the state of testing in Minnesota is that we do have two testing labs that are licensed. One of them has a number of variances to ensure they can meet the full panel testing requirements. We have a third licensed lab that is currently testing a single panel. So in cannabis testing, we have panels of testing, and it's like heavy metals, pesticides, residual solvents, and then the sort of cannabinoid profiles, like how many milligrams of THC are in the product. And there's, I think, 9 total panels that we test for across various product and product types at various points in the supply chain. And so labs can be licensed for one and up to all of those panels for testing. So we have two licensed that can test all panels, one license that tests a single panel. We also have an additional, so there were 18 total applications for testing facilities in the state of Minnesota. 12 of those came during the initial application round in 24 and 25. Recognizing the importance of building a strong testing supply, the office reopened for testing, laboratory testing licenses in June of 2025 and had 6 additional applicants in that time. 2 of those additional applicants are now on the precipice of licensure. They've made it through the complete process and are in the final steps, which is actually the most important step, which is that unlike every other cannabis business that just has to go through and check the boxes and show us that they can run a business, they have security, they've thought it out, they've done the things necessary. Because the testing facilities are using scientific methods, high-dollar equipment to break down the product, test the product, and determine whether or not it's safe for consumption, we request as part of the licensing process that those laboratories go through a process called method validation, where they show us the underlying scientific work that proves when they run the test, the results that come out of that testing machine will be the same every single time if the inputs are the same every single time. So that need for consistency is really what underpins the entire testing model, that if you can't rely on the results, the testing doesn't necessarily do anything for you. So we have 2 labs that are in that final stage, which really is the last step before licensure. And so we have confidence that 2 of those will be coming online in the next weeks to months to help alleviate some of that concern. Those do include those new applicants, part of an outreach effort the office engaged in throughout 2025, which was not just to open the application window, but to seek out potential applicants for this particular industry. That includes operators of laboratories in border states that were testing hemp products for Minnesota producers anyway, trying to entice them to enter Minnesota, open operations across the border, and sort of serve this market. And so certainly we see that capacity coming online. We have an additional 5 licensed applicants in the stage where they're doing their sort of sourcing of materials, sourcing of location, finding a spot, and building out their locations that we anticipate may additionally come online later this year. That said, overall, markets of similar size at launch have had similar amounts of licensed labs, you know, at this point. And so it's sort of a universal reality of launching a completely intrastate market that has to have all the product but also all the ancillary services built, that usually this sort of early stage, you see some of these delays because both the testing facilities are working on improving their methods, you know, standardizing operating procedures and increasing speed to return results. But you're also dealing with cultivators and manufacturers who are turning out product for the first time. And so if anyone's like a baker, oftentimes the first run through of a recipe gets a little dodgy, and the more you do it, the better your product turns out. And so there's also greater variability in the products at the start of the market, which make testing more difficult.
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for giving us an update on that and even a time frame and not just dodging the question.
Chair. Representative Hansen.
I just realized it's the morning time. I'm not a morning person. I said March 1st, 2027 was the date. It's May 1st. I just
thank you for that clarification.
The bill does say May 1st.
Thank you. Representative Cassisa Batoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question is to Director Taubel. I'm hopeful since the expiration that's in statute was already passed January 1st. Obviously, the legislature couldn't do anything to change that prior to it occurring. But in your response to Representative West, you mentioned some waivers. So are the businesses currently operating in Minnesota all operating with a waiver, or are they unable to test at this point in time? Can you just give us an update on what's happening in the market?
Director.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So On our website, we maintain a list of every licensed laboratory and what panels they're licensed for, and then indicate whether or not those panels are operating under a variance. And for us, the variance really is the ongoing method validation process and engagement. And so, for instance, one of the labs that has a variance has operated in this market, in the medical marijuana market, for years. And so they've been running tests on these panels consistently over time. And so with those, we felt comfortable giving them a variance. And so we have, with the testing facilities, worked to where we have flexibility and where we have the ability to be nimble, done both of those things to try to ensure we can build that capacity. I think it's consistent with one of the legislative proposals we came forth last year that this body moved forward and passed, which also allows now for labs that haven't yet been certified by the International Standards Organization for their methods and processes to be licensed during that process to, again, increase the amount of capacity. But we're always balancing that capacity against the need to ensure that a Minnesota buying a product can believe that if it says there's not more residual solvents or more heavy metals in the edible than there should be, that they can trust that it's not. So it's a balancing act for sure, but we've tried to make smart decisions that kind of reflect that need for additional capacity balanced against public safety.
Representative Kutun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess I appreciate that. Just for further clarification, so to your knowledge, manufacturers in Minnesota are not experiencing kind of like a hold on their production at this point in time, given those variances that you, that the department has approved, or the office has approved, excuse me, Director?
Chair, Representative, thank you, Virgin. So we actually, in the, one of the things we also do is we're constantly engaged in conversation and dialogue with testing facilities to see what's happening, and as well as engaged with manufacturers and processors to see what they're experiencing. At present, the turnaround times for testing results are running anywhere between 6 to 9 weeks, which is a pretty big timeline. And ideally, we would like to see it at like the 10-day kind of turnaround. And so we're inquiring about what's taking so long, what the issues are, so that we can sort of peek in and try to do what we can to help. That's in part why we think this bill is really helpful, because, you know, part of the backlog is there's just a lot of product to be tested. And with moving hemp out of state, you know, we would be able to, we think, get those timelines down. For businesses in the cannabis space, those long timelines are not great, and they aren't good for business. At the same time, there's clarity that the Minnesota cannabis market will continue to exist for years to come. And so, you know, 6 weeks isn't great, but it's livable. For these hemp businesses, you know, we're looking at 9 months or so left before the federal definition functionally ends the market. And so a 6 week chunk there is substantial. And so I think that's why we think this bill that Representative Hansen has brought forward is really helpful for industry, and especially as we're sort of in this early launch phase of the cannabis side.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director, and thank you, Representative Hansen. I think that, you know, having you on this committee with your expertise and your willingness to work across the aisle with Representative West really benefits us all, and I appreciate your work.
Thank you. We have about 3 minutes left, and Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I guess, is around a little broader implementation of this. A year ago, you were here, and you told us you were building the agency.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was struck and by, kind of stunned by the number of people you were building this agency to, number of staff, full-time employees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just wondering, is this a one-time bridge to full implementation? Can you give me a little more background about that? And again, I would think with the number of full-time people you are bringing in to start this agency, I wouldn't think we'd be here today. So,
Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. Yes, this is just a one-time bridge for now. I'll come back to you next session and after the feds make their decisions. There is really great advocacy and lobbying happening, including by members on this committee, who are working with our federal partners to try to stand up for these small businesses. And so this current bill before us right now, the office really doesn't have much to do with it because the legislature dictates how they do business and what they have to carry out. And so this is our way of telling them that they don't have to start enforcing that local Minnesota-based hemp businesses who have been sending their products out of state for testing since 2018 are now required to do it as of the first. So it does actually alleviate them and maybe require fewer workers to continue doing extra work. Hopefully this will alleviate some stuff until end of next session.
Well, we do have two people left on the list, Representative Cha and Representative Allen. Are you able to go very, very quickly? Because we have like 1 minute. So Representative
Just Cha. Very quick. Can you give a quick update on revenues and volume of cannabis sale in Minnesota?
Director?
Chair, Representative Cha, thank you for the question. So actually about a month ago, the office launched what we call the market, cannabis market dashboard, OCU market dashboard, our website that tracks month over month sales in the AU and in the medical markets. For the first 2.5 months, we were doing around 7.5 million of AU sales a month. We've now climbed to, as of January, almost 11 million in AU sales, an additional 7.9 in medical. We think that AU number will continue to rise at a relatively strong clip as we continue to onboard more operators.
Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go quick. You, Director, you said in your testimony that you guys are actively trying to woo individuals across the border in, from Wisconsin into Minnesota to do testing. It's our job to set out the standards and everything that has to go into doing this, producing the product and making sure they hit our standards. So why are we arbitrarily limiting outstate testing at all? Could you please explain that to me?
Okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Right now, because of the 2018 Farm Bill, it's legal for hemp to go across state lines because there's an interstate market right now. But as of, depending on what the feds do, as of November 12th of 2026, that will not be allowed anymore, so they won't be able to send it out of state. So it is quite devastating to see an interstate market just completely collapse like this, especially one that's flourishing the way it has and has saved so many local small businesses. And so partnering right now across state lines is an option, but it won't be if we don't see changes from the federal government on this.
Thank you. Chair O'Driscoll.
I have no comments.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, can I make a motion to refer this bill to the General Register, please?
So moved. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. You are on your way to the General Register. And with that, we have completed our business and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.